Chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. I'm thrilled to have Arnold Donald on the show today. Arnold is the president and chief executive officer of Carnival Cruise Lines. Arnold, I am so excited for this interview today. We were trying to figure it out. I think it was probably 2000, 2001 that Greg and I met you when Zachary and Jordan were doing Odyssey of the Mind.
Yep, it was a little while ago. You haven't aged like a day. On the other hand, I've aged quite a bit. So have the kids. The kids are now all grown. But it was a very fortunate meeting and then a great experience with the kids with Odyssey of the Mind and the homeschooling and everything and our shared interest in the Independence Center and all that. So it's just good to be with you, Lisa.
Yes. Well, it's good to be with you, too. And I'm excited about this interview. I know most people know you, Arnold, but for those two or three out there who don't, I am excited for them to get to know you today. And so I want to go back to how you grew up. I knew you grew up in New Orleans. You were the youngest of five.
Sure. I was very fortunate. I grew up in a loving family, had both parents, which wasn't a given in the neighborhood I grew up in. I grew up in the Ninth Ward in New Orleans. People know folks from there like Marshall Falk, grew up in the same area I did. He's a lot younger, but we grew up in the same area and in others. And there's been some movies out recently focused on the Ninth Ward and what have you. But it was a tough area. And I grew up and we were very poor. My dad was super hardworking and so was my mom. But I grew up in the segregated South. And so at the time, separate water fountains, separate bathrooms, limited opportunities for my parents, frankly. And I grew up at the right time. So I grew up, became of age in the late 60s. So right in the middle of the civil rights movement and a lot of change and man going to the moon, all things were possible. They often say the times make the person doesn't make the times. And I would say that's, very true in my case.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, I never had an opportunity to meet your mom and dad, but I have the utmost respect because I know you guys grew up very poor. I think you have said they didn't even finish high school, but they not only had the five of you, but they took in 27 foster kids.
Yes, they did. Over time, 27, they were very giving. And our house was always the house. We were Catholic and parish. And, the kids in the parish would always show up at our house. And whenever there were issues and challenges, they would come to my mom and dad for consultation and come and live with us for a while. But then the formal parenting of foster children of over 27 of them. And so they were very giving people. I hope I picked up some of that and, I try to make sure that I make a difference in my own way, but they were exceptionally giving people.
Oh my goodness. I have the utmost respect.
And focused on education, as you said, Lisa. I mean, they didn't have the opportunity for high school where they grew up in Convent, Louisiana. And then they moved to New Orleans, once they were married and everything. But they made sure because they hadn't had that opportunity, they made sure we all did. And so myself and my siblings, had college and so on. And it's just a testament to bettering others.
Deep-rooted, amazing values. And so, you know, you said you hope you make a difference. You definitely have in so many ways, and we're going to get into that. But I have to have you tell our listeners about your sisters. So you were the youngest.
Yeah, I'm the baby. Gotta love me. And so my youngest sister is 3 years older than me. My oldest sister is 13 years or 14 years older than me. But my youngest sister, Yvonne, she wanted to be a teacher from a very early age, first grade for her or kindergarten or something. And so I was her first student. She taught me to read and write and do simple arithmetic. And, you know, the rod was one of her favorite things. You know, back then they would whack you in the hand with a rod, and she liked doing that. And so anyway, she taught me some basic stuff. I had the original Head Start program. And then when I went to school, they thought I was some kind of little genius because I could do all the stuff that first or second graders could do. But I had just been taught early. Back then, what happened was, you know, they invested in you if they thought you had a little something. And my early stage, where I read everything. And so that really came, though, from my sister, who kind of, you know, inspired it in me. And in addition to the little rod, she probably gave me little rewards, which I don't remember, a piece of candy. Who knows what she did? But it inspired me. I had a thirst for learning at a very early age, and it served me well.
I just love that story. I've never forgotten it. And I remember you telling me that very, very early on. So she was extraordinary, too.
But Lisa, you know, she messed up, though, because when I went to school for the first time, she said, now, when the teacher asks you your name, you make sure you tell her your name is Arnold Donald. And I said, I'm not going to lie to my teacher. She said, what are you talking about? I said, my name's Wayne. And she always had me sign Wayne. My middle name's what the family called me. And she never had me write Arnold Donald because she was little herself, you know. Say, you stupid boy, your name is Arnold Donald. Tell your teacher and stuff. And I started crying like, I'm not going to lie to my teacher on the first day and all this stuff. So she had to call my other sister over, who I trusted, and said, your name is Arnold Donald. So there you go. So all that learning, I didn't even know my name.
The other part you didn't tell me was the rod part, you know. And I, she had some leadership skills. She knew about carrots and sticks before carrots and sticks were cool.
Exactly.
I want to fast forward a little bit to when you went to St. Augustine. And I know that St. Augustine High School was an all-boys Catholic school. Hard to get into, I think.
St. Augustine is an all-boys Catholic high school. At the time, it was the only all-boy Catholic high school that African-Americans could attend. It was in the middle of integration. I was going from elementary school into junior high. And my mom was afraid to send me to the junior high school because the junior high school previously had been, you know, all white. And she was concerned there'd be issues and, you know, I might experience physical harm. And I couldn't go to the school my brothers and sisters went to because the school system was directing integration. So she put me in the local parish school for seventh grade. And there all the boys were taking the exam to go to St. Augustine. And I had no interest because my siblings had gone to Carver. My brother had been a track star there and blah, blah, blah. He was 8 years older than me, but, you know, I was wanting to follow in his footsteps. And I just went along and took the test with everybody else. And it turned out I scored really well on the test. I think they said the second or the highest in the city or something. So everybody was super excited about it at the school. And my mom and dad really wanted me to go there. And so that led me going to a summer program, which is what you're thinking of. They took 60 kids from the test and they put them in a summer program, 8 a.m. till noon for a number of weeks in the summer. And the first day they said, 30 of you won't make it. We're only taking 30 into the class. They gave us some lessons and gave us the rules and all that. And right before noon, they handed us the book, Oliver Twist. And they said, you're going to have a test on this tomorrow. Kid raised his hand and said, well, you know, how much of it? They said, all of it. And as you well know, Oliver Twist is a pretty thick book. And so one day to read it. So I went home and I read like crazy. I started reading backwards. I started at the end to find out what happened at the end in case I fell asleep and so on. My mom said, boy, I go to sleep. And I stayed up all night reading. Went in and took the test. And myself and another guy were the only two that got in the high 90s. Everybody else failed because everybody else used Cliff Notes, which I knew nothing about. If I had known, I would have used them too, but I didn't know. So they knew people would use Cliff Notes. And so they had the whole thing rigged. So if you did Cliff Notes, there wasn't one question asked that you could answer from Cliff Notes. And their point was, and that first day is, at St. Augustine High School and in life, there are no shortcuts. And it sunk in right away with me and it stayed with me forever. And three times a day, in the morning when we arrived, at lunch and at the end of the day, over the intercom system in the classrooms, they would say, gentlemen, prepare yourselves. You're going to run the world. So three times a day, they barked that at us. And integration was going, the school had gone to court in Louisiana. In fact, there's stuff at the National African American Art Museum in Washington, D.C., around St. Aug and the lawsuits and stuff. So they could integrate Mardi Gras, our band marched in the Mardi Gras parades, first black bands to march in Mardi Gras parade along with Southern University. They went to court to integrate high school athletics, because the athletics at the time were segregated. And so when I went in eighth grade, all of that was happening. We're playing the majority schools and sports, and I joined the band, marched in the Mardi Gras parades and so on. So it was a big time of change. That was in the late 60s. And it was just a very impressionable time, and a time that you really felt the school was super successful, won the national debate contest. We've had over 40-something guys in the NFL. The editor of the New York Times right now is from St. Augustine. John Batiste, the band on the late night show, is St. Aug grad. On and on and on. And a number of executives around. One of my close friends from my class, the other guy who did well on that first test, he ended up being one of the top 10 guys in IBM before he retired. And so this little tiny high school, but just with a lot of values and principles and discipline, really instilled in us the concept of excellence, what it takes to achieve. And that's kind of the story of St. Aug.
There's so many lessons in there. I'm thinking about the Cliff Notes, and I'm thinking, like you said, there are no shortcuts. Don't cut corners in life. It will come back to bite you. Going the extra mile almost always pays off, right? The words matter.
Yeah, words matter.
They were trying to get you guys to believe in yourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what they were doing.
Wow. Such a powerful story. I'm so grateful.
And it shows you the power of education. People invest in you, like my sister invests in me, but also my elementary school teachers and then St. Augustine. And if you're open-minded enough to accept that investment, it really can make all the difference in the world. There's no question.
Well, I have one more question for you, and then we need to take a quick break. But you had a plan, and so I want you to tell our listeners, Arnold, about that. And then that's going to be a great segue into getting into what we're going to talk about.
Early on, my original plan before St. Aug was I was going to be president of the United States, the starting quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, and an astronaut all at the same time. But then as I matured, I thought, well, maybe I better prioritize. And so I ended up my junior in high school deciding I was going to be a general manager in a Fortune 50 science-based global company. And then I mapped out a plan of exactly how I was going to make that happen. Clearly, I had no idea what that was, because nobody in my family was even in business at all. And I had read a lot, but you can only get so much from reading. So I didn't really have a great concept of what it was. But I'm sure it was a combination of reading, meeting a few people, and the instructors at the school. And I'm sure they brainwashed me into, where I ended up. But the bottom line was, that's what I decided to be. And I put a plan together and I executed the plan.
I love that. More people need to put plans together and we can talk about that. But we need to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Arnold Donald.
Let's face it, the future is mobile. There's a good chance that you are listening to this show right now on your phone. Have you explored how you can move your business mobile too? Our mobile apps team at Technology Partners makes it their mission to move our clients into the hands of their employees and customers and change their business processes to meet the demands of their users. Let's work together and build a dynamic mobile app for your team. Go to tpi.co/mobile apps and get the conversation started about how we can help you get your new application off the ground.
Welcome back, everybody. I want to talk to you. You had a plan. Start with your plan. I mean, you had multiple scholarships, but you chose to go to Minnesota. And then I want you to talk about your education, and then we'll move into what you were doing at Monsanto.
Yeah, so my plan, I started out saying to be a general manager in a Fortune 50 science-based global company, I'm going to need a science degree. I'm going to need an MBA, and I want them from the best places I can get them. So for the MBA, I'm going to have some credentials to get me into the best MBA school. So I mapped out a plan to do two undergraduate degrees. I took econ because I liked it, so a liberal arts degree, and then engineering for my science, and I decided mechanical engineering. And I thought, if I have two undergraduate degrees, that'll differentiate me a little bit from all those folks applying to get into the best business schools. So that was the plan I mapped out, and I actually negotiated with a number of universities that got accepted to Stanford and Yale and Princeton and others. But I wanted to also have a differentiated experience. I wanted a small liberal arts experience, and then a university professional school experience. And so I negotiated with Stanford, because that was my first choice, that I would go to this liberal arts college in Minnesota, Carleton College, first, do my econ degree and all the pre-work I required for the engineering school, and then do the engineering work at Stanford. So I negotiated with them. They had given me a scholarship, and that was my plan. I started out that way. I went to Carleton. I picked Carleton because it was small. I'm from New Orleans. I was a little bit of a hothead. I knew I needed an environment where I would be more focused. And I thought Northfield, Minnesota, small little town, cold as anything in the winter, be a good place to focus and keep me out of trouble. So I had Carleton and Stanford. That was my plan. So I went to Carleton, told everybody I was going to do 2 degrees. They laughed at me and said, you'd be lucky to get one. But I did. I accelerated everything. In fact, I could have graduated Carleton in 3 years, but I left my PE credit off because my scholarship, I had a scholarship from Sun Oil Company, a national achievement scholarship. And it was 4 years or graduation, whichever occurs first. I thought I could use the scholarship for the 4th year. So I did that and then ended up at Wash University in St. Louis, met and married my wife at Carleton. She decided to do 3-2. She's a math major, and she decided to do 3-2 engineering as well. Wash U gave us a great package. I was going to honor my commitment to Stanford, but they said, look, you should go where you really want to go. Don't come just because you made a commitment to us and so on. And Wash University gave us a better package as a couple and was a great, you know, university and really liked the people here. So I did my engineering at Wash University in St. Louis, which is my big connection in St. Louis, as you know, Lisa, which got me to St. Louis and everything. And then that was the story on the education front, knowing I was going to do an MBA. So for the MBA, I had the options, again, Harvard and University of Chicago and Stanford and whatnot. And I decided to go to University of Chicago because, again, differentiating myself to be a general manager in a Fortune 50 science-based global company, I thought if I had the working experience along with the prestige MBA, it was better than just having a prestige MBA. And University of Chicago had the only part-time program where it wasn't an asterisk at that time. So if I did Harvard's program that way or Stanford's, there was an asterisk to differentiate it from their full-time program. University of Chicago, there was no distinction. That's why I chose that and told Monsanto that if they made me an offer in Chicago, I'd consider it. I'd work one summer in the linear programming model, and everybody was so impressed. They offered me a job right after the summer assignment, subject to graduation. And I told them, I had like 19 job offers, and I said, I'll consider it, but it has to be in Chicago. And it has to be in the detergents and phosphates division, because I had done my homework to figure out what was the fast track division inside the company. You know, I'd gone to meet with the president of the company, and which was a riot, because the people that were overseeing me for the summer said, you can't just make an appointment to meet with the president of the company. And what are you doing? I did it. He accepted it. I'm going. It was a summer job. What are they going to do? Fire me? You know, so it was like, it was okay. And that's what they told us at St. Aug, you know. So, and I went to see him to ask him, what does it take to get to your job? And tell me about your job. What do you like about it? What don't you like about it? What mistakes did you make? So on and so forth. Anyway, make a long story short, I ended up taking a job in Chicago and doing the MBA at the University of Chicago in finance because, again, I knew I'd need finance to be a general manager, but I hated it. So my attitude was, I'll take it in university and try to not to, you know, spend as little time as possible working at it.
What you knew that you needed to be well-rounded. You needed to at least understand these different areas, right?
Right, exactly.
So that's a great lesson there. But I love that you had the courage and just, what's the worst thing that can happen?
What's the worst that can happen?
Great leadership lessons. Well, here's the deal. You were wildly successful at Monsanto. I know that you were president of the consumer and nutrition sector, as well as the ag sector. You had a great career there.
It was fantastic. And Monsanto had a lot of very bright and brilliant people. I had scores of mentors there along the way who invested in me and gave me opportunities. And it was a fantastic experience and taught me so many life lessons and values. We did a strategic planning session at one point. We said, what's the most important thing for a company? And I had my University of Chicago training, and I said, you know, maximize return to the shareholders over the life of the firm. Grow earnings this year, leave a base to grow again next year, and you'll do that. And since it's over the life of the firm, you absolutely have to be a good corporate citizen because you need freedom to operate. So you have to do the right things in the communities you're in and all that. Otherwise, you'll lose your freedom to operate and you won't be able to satisfy the show. So I had that pat answer. He said, anybody else has any thoughts? And we ended up with a vision statement, which was abundant food and a healthy environment for everyone on the planet. And it wasn't just a vision statement. And we said, what are we going to do to contribute to that? And we said, we're going to transform the way food is produced. And we made that our focus, and we set about doing that. And we got out of businesses that weren't related to that, out of businesses that were causing pollution, and we didn't have good solutions to really significantly reduce the pollution or waste. We exited businesses. It wasn't just a statement. It was followed up by real action. And the company, you know, became wildly successful, and I was lucky to play a part in that.
I love the mission and the vision of Monsanto to feed the world. But to your point, you can have that statement, Arnold, but you have got to have actions to back it up.
Got to live it.
So I love that. Well, so then in 2000, though, I want to kind of fast forward here a little bit. Monsanto actually sold off their tabletop sweetener brand, which was Equal.
You know, it's a fascinating business story. We don't have time to go through it all now. But the bottom line was we had a vision at one point of becoming a $1 trillion market cap company because we were going to change the way food produced and protect the environment. And we were looking at a number of mergers. To do that, we're going to have to merge with other companies. We're looking at a number of mergers, and we had made a commitment to acquire a lot of assets, basically seed assets that had germplasm in the seed that gave the characteristics that we could put our genetics into for, you know, the biotech products, products improved through the use of modern biotechnology, Roundup Ready soybeans, BT cotton, et cetera. So that was the backdrop for it. And we had gotten to the point of a merger, and we decided not to do the merger. And at that point, we had a lot of commitments out to acquire things. We were a $20 billion market cap company. We had about $8 billion of acquisition commitments. And our CFO at the time said, we got to get some cash in here in case we had a bump in the road. So we decided to sell off non-strategic assets. And that's where you reference, you know, we decided to sell off the sweetener business, which was very profitable, but non-strategic. And a number of other, we had a kelp business, which was the alginate business. We had a few other businesses. And I was put in charge of divesting that suite of businesses. And one of them was Equal Sweetener. So the tabletop business. We also had NutraSweet, which was the ingredient business that went into Coke and Pepsi and other things. But the tabletop that you see in restaurants and in the grocery store was Equal. And I had a good buddy who was in private equity at the time. I had gone to engineering school with him, Andy Bursky. He's on the board with me now at WashU. And I said, Andy has a great business. High yield market was in the tank. So we couldn't fool around. And we said, look, $600 million for this business, no financing contingency, 45 days to close. Great business. You want it, you can have it. If not, you know, that's it, but no negotiating. So Andy was like, Arnold, look, if you tell me it's a good deal, I know it is because we're very close friends. And he said, when I go to my partners to say, give me $600 million because my friend says this is a good deal, they're going to laugh me out the room. He said, so only way this is going to work with no financing contingency or anything is if you come with it. Because everybody knows you and they know what you're, you know, what you can do at Monsanto over time. But if you come, they're going to say, this must be a really good deal. So you have to come with me. We always say we do something together. And I laughed and said, are you out of your mind? It's a $300 million business. I'm running a multi-billion dollar thing here with lots of technology. He said, come with me because then you can play with everybody's technology. And I said, no, man, I don't think so. And he said, look, we got to do it to do the deal. I said, I tell you what, put me in as a contingency for the deal. Because if you do, I know once you see these numbers, you saw me, you're going to forget all about me and just want to buy the thing. So he said, are you sure? I said, yes. I said, okay. So he put me in. I was immediately conflicted because so I couldn't run the business anymore because I was conflicted. I'm in the deal. And he knew that would happen. And so he just worked on me every day. And one thing led to another. And I did it for fun, to be honest. We did the deal and had a blast, and made another nickel, and we formed the company Marison. And man, it had 19 brands around the world, including Equal Sweetener. We had good fun with it. We made money on it, and I broke away and did some entrepreneurial stuff.
Yeah, so then that leads me up to kind of, you were the CEO for JDRF, or ELC, Executive Leadership Council, which I'd love for you to tell our listeners about. I didn't even know about Executive Leadership Council, but I'm like, how needed is this?
When I went to JDRF first, I did it again as a way to give back, but I was CEO and we really kicked off the closed loop artificial pancreas project. And now that's actually commercial and being used. I'm really proud about that. It was a great experience and just wonderful people involved there. And then Executive Leadership Council, the CEOs, one or two levels below Fortune 500 companies, African American. And so that was the membership. When I was there and I led it as the CEO of that, the membership aligned around an objective of expanding the number in the C-suite and the number of African-Americans on boards of directors, because in both cases, the numbers had been flat to declining over a number of years. So we were just not at a critical mass of having good diversity representation from the African-American community in corporate America. You know, I felt proud to help facilitate them aligning around that. There's also a host of management development programs and leadership development programs that ELC oversees to help the talent develop and share best practices and learnings and so on. And then networking, you know, driving the business success of the individuals at the various corporations. So that's what it's all about. I'm still a member. I had been a member for a number of years before I took over as CEO, because I basically retired after the Marathon experience. And I went on a number of boards, publicly traded company boards, private equity boards, including eventually Carnival.
Arnold, I just remember at one point talking with you, and we were talking about boards, and I thought I was busy. and then you're like, oh yeah, I'm on, I don't know, 18 boards.
It was a lot of boards. But I have a team. I have my own personal family office. I have a team of people that keep me organized and support me. And without the team, I couldn't do it.
Right. There's a lesson there too.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, for those that try to do it all, so much of what we say, it's stratification of work. So if you've got somebody that's better at scheduling than you are, let them do it. And you do what you're good at, let them do what they're good at. But that's a good leadership tip too, to recognize in your people where they're really gifted and then empower them to go do it. So that brings us up to Carnival, because you'd served on the board for quite a few years.
Yeah, for 13 years. I'd gone on the board when I was at Marathon, actually, because Andy had a co-investor, a guy named Uzi Zucker, is general manager of Bear Stearns. And Uzi was on the governance committee for Carnival. And so we would meet in New York to discuss the Marathon business. But Uzi was checking me out all along for the Carnival board. And then the opportunity presented itself, and I ended up joining the board and built a great relationship with the board members and with Mickey Arison, who family founded the company. And Mickey had been chairman and CEO for quite a while. And Mickey got to the point where he wanted to give up the CEO role and just stay as chairman. And he asked me to do it. He and the board asked me to do it. And I almost said no on the spot, because I was cruising through life and wasn't looking for a job or anything, and never had thought about running this company. And I'd never even crossed my mind. But he and I had a long conversation, and one thing led to another. I decided to do it. And that was something I didn't plan. You know, my plan as a general manager in a science-based company, Fortune 50, we were Fortune 100, not Fortune 50. But I achieved that at age 32 or something at Monsanto. So this was totally unexpected. And I was an idiot. I should have been begging for the job. It was absolutely the best job ever, because it's such a wonderful, it's a human spirit-based business. It's hospitality. People go on cruises. What they always remember are the other people, either the crew or other guests. It's such a powerful human spirit. You know, we bring people together. We have crew members from 145 different countries and guests from 190 different countries. And so we bring people together and they discover what they have in common, so that they don't fear the differences. They actually celebrate what they have in common, and it just brings the world together. It elevates the standards of social justice. And so that's the essence of this business, and it's a riot. Plus, as an engineer, I get to play with big toys. I have cities at sea with the ships. But it's such a wonderful human spirit experience.
You know, you've just done a great job since you've been there. I think earnings in that has doubled, at least doubled, since you took over as CEO in 2013.
But I've led us to zero revenues. I mean, we have no revenue now. We have expenses because the ships have to keep sailing. Otherwise, they'll lock up in the assets. So we have about a $600 million a month burn rate. And I've had to raise over $19 billion in capital over the last several months to give us a runway of liquidity so we can weather the storm. But we'll be back. I mean, there's no question about it. The world's going to get this thing under control, mitigate the risk of long-term negative effects from COVID or worse. And when that happens, social activities will begin again, and cruise will be at the top.
Absolutely. I believe that too. Well, I mean, how have you seen technology implement the hospitality business, the cruise lines? I mean, what have you...
Yeah, we have technology all through. We're everything. We're a hotel, we're restaurants, we're a casino, we're theaters. We're one of the largest art dealers in the world, et cetera, et cetera. The ships are at sea. They have to stay connected. We've got satellite technology, et cetera. But one of the things we did internally when I first came, I asked, what's the most critical thing about our business? And our highest priorities, and therefore our top responsibilities always, are compliance, environmental protection, and the health, safety, and well-being of our guests, of the people in the communities we touch and serve, and of course, our Carnival family, and that's our shoreside and our shipboard personnel. And if we do that right, then we earn the privilege to exceed guest expectations. And if we do that, we get great returns for the shareholders. So exceeding guest expectations, I look for who is the world's greatest innovator in guest experience. And so I stole this guy who used to be at Disney. He did Fast Pass and Magic Wand and all that. Years later, I ended up giving the keynote address at the Consumer Electronics Show with our technology. So we had one of the most ambitious Internet of Things projects on the planet. And we call it Ocean, is our platform. A key aspect of it is a little medallion that you carry, and it's like a license plate. It identifies you. We encrypted it anyway, but it identifies you, has no other information in it. But it connects to sensors all over the ship, and there's portals all over the ship. So when you walk in the bar, they know your name, they know who you are, they know what your drink is if you've ordered a drink before. They say, well, would you like your usual or would you like something else? It's contactless. You don't need to have a room key to open your cabin door. It recognizes you when you get to your cabin door. The portals and the crew all know whatever they need to know about you, your itinerary, your history, your birthday, you know, whatever it is. And so it's high touch because in the end, we're all like your phone. We all may have iPhones, but your phone is unique because you've customized it to what you want. And so in the end, we want travel to feel customized to your individual preference. This technology allows us to do that in a very powerful way. So that's where ultimately it's going. And we're very proud of it. It's on our Princess line. But we have so much technology throughout the fleet in so many other ways. Our Carnival brand hasn't yet adopted the Ocean platform, but they have, you know, super fast embarkation, chat ability on board. They have some ordering capabilities on board as well, as do our other many brands, AIDA in Germany, Costa, P&O in the UK, Cunard, Queen Mary 2 is one of ours, as you know, Lisa, Holland America, Seabourn, all of our brands. We have 9 of them, 700 destinations around the world, and they are ripe with technology and leading edge technology.
That is awesome. I did not know that, but wow. I mean, the customer experience.
Yeah, it's all about the guest experience.
Investing in that is so good. So this is something extra. Arnold, what do you believe is the something extra that every leader needs?
Every leader really needs to listen, because the world will reveal itself to you. But a leader really has to be able to hear the so-called followers, what their needs, aspirations, and wants are. Because when you can connect with people at that very fundamental level of what they're interested in, what they need, and find a way to marry that with the task that you've set out, then you've got a home run. And that's the magic. And in a simple example, which is the easiest one I can come up with, is juvenile diabetes for me, that experience. The one common thing everybody had, they wanted a cure for their loved one or for themselves. And so that was the common denominator. So no matter what the debate was, I could always ask the question, what's going to get us to a cure faster? And while there may not have been agreement on what might get us there fastest or faster, there was an agreement on what the intent was. And that created the opportunity for cooperation, collaboration, and communication. And when you have those things, there's nothing you can't do.
Yeah. Oh, such great words. Well, Arnold, is there something coming up that you want our listeners to know about?
Absolutely. I want you guys to know that we will be resuming cruising at some point in time. So I would love all of you to plan ahead. If you've never cruised, talk to someone who is. Don't just take my word for it. Talk to someone who has and let them tell you about it, because many people haven't cruised because they think they know what it's like. And the reality is it's not like that at all. So talk to someone you trust that has cruise, and you will hear the great experience of cruise. And then, of course, cruise on one of our brands, the one that works best for you, because they're all different.
And there's 9 of them, right?
And there's 9 of them. And Seabourn is ultra luxury. Carnival is super fun. And so it just depends what you're looking for. But anyway, that would be my request from a business standpoint. And then from a personal standpoint, I would just ask anyone that listens to this to not just look at others, but ask yourself, what can you as an individual personally do to elevate social justice and the standards for social justice for another human being, for a group, weighing in on legislation that's going on in your community, whatever it is, whatever you can personally do. And what I mean by elevate the standard of social justice is everybody has an opportunity. People are just treated fairly. And this is for everyone. Yes, it's for diversity and all that, but it's for everyone. It's social justice for everyone. Because if we all collectively do that, we will absolutely have a better world.
I could not agree with you more. That is beautiful. Well, Arnold, this has been so much fun. I so appreciate you making the time. I know how busy you are. So I'm so honored and humbled that you would make the time to be on the show. But I know your words and the conversation we had today is going to impact people. And so you are making a difference. So keep shining your light. And it's good to see you, my friend.
Lisa, great to be with you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.